Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org.
Oil's going the other way.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. We're starting to see what a recession might do to the price of oil. This morning, oil's trading at less than $93 a barrel. Oil prices have dropped $7 over the past week or so. All this talk of recession has traders thinking there will be less demand. Could be a welcome development for your wallet. The recent spike in oil has shown up at the gas station. Gas prices are 10 cents higher in the last 3 weeks. The national average this morning is $3.07. Stock prices have certainly taken a hit from all the recession talk. The Dow fell another 1.5% last week. The NASDAQ dropped 2.5%. So the Dow begins this week at 12,606. It gave back 246 points on Friday. The NASDAQ is at 2439. The S&P 500 is at 1401. European shares are up a small fraction so far today. In Asia, stocks fell 0.33%. The Asian markets are off to their worst start for a year in a decade. Congress goes back to work tomorrow after the winter break. On the agenda, what to do, if anything, about the housing market. More now from Danielle Carson in Washington.
The House and Senate have proposals to deal with the housing mess, but John Irons with the Economic Policy Institute says time is running out.
The problem is that this is spilling over to the broader economy, to all kinds of home buyers, homeowners, and it's going to have a reverberating effect throughout the economy.
Irons says proposals in Congress to let bankruptcy judges change the terms of a mortgage and to allow the Federal Housing Administration offer refinancing deals to many more mortgage holders is a start, but
that's not going to impact a big swath of the population who have gotten themselves into houses and seen the prices drop on those houses.
So what's left for Congress to do? Not much.
Put a moratorium on foreclosures to provide people with temporary assistance, or to encourage a lot of renegotiation between borrowers and lenders to make sure that people can stay in their homes.
But with unemployment climbing to 5%, home foreclosures at record highs, and housing prices dropping, some analysts say recession is unavoidable. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace.
The Detroit Auto Show gets going today, and guess what the resounding theme is already? Greenness. Yesterday, GM announced a deal with a startup company that produces ethanol from agricultural leftovers and garbage, basically. Today, Toyota will show off a new hybrid pickup truck that's built on a car platform. And Ford unveils an SUV that's mostly recycled. The seats came from passenger jets. Parts of the body were made from old soft drink bottles. You're listening to the Morning Report for Monday, January 14th on Marketplace.org. Amtrak and its unions are supposed to resume contract talks this week. Amtrak workers are threatening to walk off the job at the end of the month. A strike would certainly mean big problems for transit in the Northeast and an economic hit for those big cities. Ashley Milne-Tite reports from New York.
Almost 200,000 people a day take the commuter railroad into Penn Station. Amtrak happens to own and run much of that railroad track. Martin Robbins teaches at Rutgers University's Transportation Center. He says a strike would mean havoc for Manhattan-bound commuters.
The workers that perform the various services that keep the commuter trains running would also recognize the strike, and there would be a total shutdown in the Northeast Corridor. The economic impact of that would be catastrophic.
But Ross Capon of the National Association of Railroad Passengers thinks a strike is unlikely. He says Amtrak will probably meet its union's demands, especially given the government's position.
They're facing a Bush-appointed presidential emergency board that sided with the unions, which is sort of an anomaly, I guess.
He does have one worry. He says Amtrak might claim it can't placate the unions without cutting passenger services. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The film Borat may have put Kazakhstan on the map for some people, but oil might keep it there. Kazakhstan is boasting the world's biggest oil discovery in 30 years. A group of oil companies led by one in Italy are developing it. More now from Megan Williams.
It was a sweet deal for the Italian Eni and its partners. Access to the world's biggest oil field in decades. Kazakhstan would share costs of production and take a slight 8% share. That was a decade ago when Kazakhstan was barely coping after communism. Crude oil was cheap, and the country was happy to attract investors. Then came costly delays and environmental concerns. Kazakhstan wanted a new deal. Now it's got one. Double its original stake, a greater share in profit, and compensation for delays. Some analysts compare the move to Russia taking over the Royal Dutch Shell project in the Pacific Ocean last year. By asserting its rights, Kazakhstan is poised to earn $7 billion more. I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Art schools are doing pretty well these days. Enrollment is up at many schools across the country. But it's still no easier to make a living in the art world than it was when Jackson Pollock was slinging paint. Commercial galleries are picky, and they prefer to go with safe or at least well-known artists. So more artists are thinking like entrepreneurs. Lisa Gray has our story.
Most budding artists don't have the money to open a gallery. Sarah Vanderbeek is one of the lucky few. She opened her gallery, Guild and Gray School, after she left New York's Cooper Union. She says, like most artists, she left school intending to continue the work she did in the classroom.
When you're in school, you're in intense dialogue, and then when you leave, you have to create that dialogue instead.
Artists love that word, dialogue. They mean the relationships they form with each other to help the creative process. When Vanderbeek opened her own gallery with two other artists, she created her own little community. She's inspiring dialogue, but that's not necessarily good business practice.
We never enter a show thinking of the business aspects or the sales. We usually just want the best exhibition that we can present and to enable the artist to whatever level they want to go to.
It's a risky approach. Artists need supportive galleries. But if a gallery can't make money, it's not much use to anyone. Joel Beck has been an artist and gallery owner since the mid-1990s. He says running his Manhattan gallery takes more than just an eye for good art.
Being an artist is a bit like running your own small business. If you're not somewhat clever about business, as an artist, you can't succeed very long.
These artist gallerists look for a happy medium. Matthew Dipple runs Museum 52 in New York's Lower East Side. He's an artist too, and he understands the importance of investing in new talent. He says he wants to encourage emerging artists, but he needs to find established artists whose work will sell.
Part of the risk of running the gallery is that you are hoping that what you find interesting and exciting, that other people will.
Artists are opening their own galleries because they don't feel represented in the commercial art world. Their friends gave them the support they needed to develop as artists. And a splash of entrepreneurial smarts is helping them thrive. In New York, I'm Lisa Gray for Marketplace.
Bank losses from subprime are still mounting. Citigroup turns in its fourth quarter numbers tomorrow, and according to CNBC, they're going to be ugly. Possibly $24 billion in write-downs. And a lot of layoffs may be coming at Citi. Perhaps 10% of the company's workforce, 20,000 jobs. Citi's cost-cutting plan might also include reducing or eliminating the dividend to shareholders.
And now it's time for the Sloan Sessions.
Up to this point, the big Wall Street banks haven't touched their dividends. They've gone overseas and sold shares to raise money, but left their dividends alone. Alan Sloan, we're hearing Citi might finally cut its dividend. Why have these banks been so hesitant so far?
They say that they want to help their shareholders. In the case of, say, Merrill Lynch, they sold $5.6 billion of common stock at a low price, and they're paying out $1.2 billion a year of dividends. You'd think it would make much more sense to sell less stock and cut the dividend. But at Merrill and at Morgan and at Citi, I think what they would tell you is that they're doing this to keep the share price up. But it astounds me that here is Citi, especially, which borrowed $7.5 billion of money at 11%, which is sort of expensive. And meanwhile, it's paying a $10.8 billion a year dividend. You'd think they'd be a lot better off just cutting the dividend in half. But then again, I guess I'm not astute enough to understand the finances of Citi, unlike, say, the previous people who were there and lost their jobs.
Well, do you think this has anything to do with the fact that Citi and Merrill and Morgan Stanley have all reached out to Middle Eastern governments, China and Singapore, and those deals are kind of bad for the existing shareholders? Do you think by not cutting the dividend, they're placating those shareholders?
I think they're trying to placate the shareholders. And the reason that all of these places are selling stock at relatively low prices is they feel they don't have a choice and they need to have the money. They're raising the money while they can get it, and it's just very expensive. But it's the old story. The existing shareholders are better off owning 95% of something and selling 5% cheap than taking the risk of owning 100% of something that really falls in price.
All right. Alan Sloan from Fortune Magazine. Thank you.
You're welcome.
China just started allowing foreign banks to come in and do joint ventures with Chinese companies. China has put limits on the investments those banks can make. The banks don't like that, but that isn't stopping them from making deals. Jill Barchet reports.
Credit Suisse said it's teaming up with a Chinese brokerage. Its global competitors aren't far behind. JP Morgan, HSBC, and Citigroup are in negotiations.
With the moratorium lifted, you're now seeing increased activity by American firms that were previously shut out of the market.
Jeremy Waterman is a Chinese specialist at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He says the banks are attracted by China's stock market. It tripled its initial public offerings last year to $60 billion. Waterman says the new rules say a foreign bank can't own more than a third of a Chinese joint venture.
What these rules still do not allow is for trading. That's really an important piece of the business that foreign securities firms would like to be able to engage in.
One other change. These new firms now have carte blanche to underwrite Chinese stocks and bonds. That's one way, at least, they'll be able to make some money on the deal. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your Monday.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.